Page 23. Chapter 6. My Marriage. My marriage was arranged. That's the way things were done then. Where there were weddings, there were arrangements. I don't mean such things as bridal outfits, flowers, banquets, and music, though we had those too. Everyone has those even now. The arrangements I mean were more devious than that. Under the old rules, only important people had marriages, because only important people had inheritances. All the rest was just copulation of various kinds, rapes or seductions, love affairs or one-night stands, with gods who said they were shepherds, or shepherds who said they were gods. Occasionally a goddess might get mixed up in it, too, dabble around in a perishable flesh like a queen playing at milkmaids. But the reward for the man was a shortened life, and often a violent death. Page 24. Immortality and mortality didn't mix well. It was fire and mud. Only the fire always won. The gods were never averse to making a mess. In fact, they enjoyed it. To watch some mortal with his or her eyes frying in their sockets through an overdose of god sex made them shake with laughter. There was something childish about the gods, in a nasty way. I can say this now because I no longer have a body. I'm beyond that kind of suffering, and the gods aren't listening anyway. As far as I can tell, they've gone to sleep. In your world, you don't get visitations from the gods the way people used to, unless you're on drugs. Where was I? Oh, yes, marriages. Marriages were for having children, and children were not toys and pets. Children were vehicles for passing things along. These things could be kingdoms, rich wedding gifts, stories, grudges, blood feuds. Through children, alliances were forged. Through children, wrongs were avenged. To have a child was to set loose a force in the world. If you had an enemy, it was best to kill his sons, even if those sons were babies. Page 25. Otherwise, they would grow up and hunt you down. If you couldn't bring yourself to slaughter them, you could disguise them and send them far away, or sell them as slaves. But as long as they were alive, they would be a danger to you. If you had daughters instead of sons, you needed to get them bred as soon as possible so you could have grandsons. The more sword wielders and spear throwers you could count on from within your family, the better, because all the other noteworthy men around were on the lookout for a pretext to raid some king or noble and carry away anything they could grab, people included. Weakness in one power holder meant opportunity for another. So every king and noble needed all the help he could get. Thus it went without saying that a marriage would be arranged for me when the time came. At the court of King Icarius, my father, they still retained the ancient custom of having contests to see who should marry a nobly born woman who was, so to speak, on the block. Page 26. The man who won the contest got the woman and the wedding, and was then expected to stay at the bride's father's palace and contribute his share of male offspring. He obtained wealth through the marriage, gold cups, silver bowls, horses, robes, weapons, all that trash they used to value so much back when I was alive. His family was expected to hand over a lot of this trash as well. I can say trash because I know where most of it ended up. It moldered away in the ground, or it sank to the bottom of the sea, or it got broken up or melted down. Some of it made its way to enormous palaces that have, strangely, no kings or queens in them. Endless processions of people in graceless clothing file through these palaces, staring at the gold cups and the silver bowls, which are not even used anymore. Then they go to a sort of market inside the palace and buy pictures of these things, or miniature versions of them that are not real silver and gold. That is why I say trash. Page 27. Under the ancient customs, the huge pile of sparkling wedding loot stayed with the bride's family in the bride's family's palace. Perhaps that is why my father had become so attached to me after having failed to drown me in the sea. Where I was, there would be the treasure. Why did he throw me in? A question still haunts me. Although I'm not altogether satisfied with the shroud-weaving explanation, I've never been able to find the right answer, even down here. Every time I see my father in the distance, wading through the asphodel, and try to catch up with him, he hurries away as if he doesn't want to face me. I've sometimes thought that I may have been a sacrifice to the god of the sea, who was known to be thirsty for human life. Then the ducks rescued me, through no act of my father's. I suppose my father could argue that he'd fulfilled his side of the bargain, if bargain it was, and that he hadn't cheated, and that if the sea god had failed to drag me down and devour me, that was his own tough luck. Page 28. The more I think about this version of events, the more I like it. It makes sense. Picture me, then, as a clever but not overly beautiful girl of marriageable age, let's say 15. Suppose I'm looking out the window of my room, which was on the second floor of the palace, down into the courtyard where the contestants are gathering, all those young hopefuls who wish to compete for my hand. I don't look directly out of the window, of course. I don't plant my elbows on the windowsill like some hulking maid and stare shamelessly. No, I peek from behind my veil and from behind the drapery. It would not do to let all those scantily clad young men see my unveiled face. The palace women have dolled me up as best they can. Minstrels have composed songs of praise in my honor, radiant as Aphrodite and all the usual claptrap. But I feel shy and miserable. The young men laugh and joke. They seem at ease with one another. They do not glance up. I know it isn't me they're after, not Penelope the duck. Page 29. It's only what comes with me, the royal connection, the pile of glittering junk. No man will ever kill himself for love of me. And no man ever did. Not that I would have wanted to inspire those kinds of suicides. I was not a man-eater. I was not a siren. I was not like Cousin Helen, who loved to make conquests just to show she could. As soon as the man was groveling, and it never took long, she'd stroll away without a backwards glance, giving that careless laugh of hers, as if she'd just been watching the palace midget standing ridiculously on his head. I was a kind girl, kinder than Helen, or so I thought. I knew I would have to have something to offer instead of beauty. I was clever, everyone said so. In fact, they said it was so much that I found it discouraging. But cleverness is a quality of man a man likes to have in his wife as long as she is some distance away from him. Up close he'll take kindness any day of the week, if there's nothing more alluring to be had. Page 30. The most obvious husband for me would have been a younger son of a king with large estates, one of King Nestor's boys, perhaps. That would have been a good connection for King Icarius. Through my veil, I studied the young men milling around down below, trying to figure out who each one was, and a thing of no practical consequence, since it wasn't up to me to choose my husband, which one I preferred. A couple of the maids were with me. They never left me unattended. I was a risk until I was safely married, because who knew what upstart fortune hunter might try to seduce me or seize me and run away with me. The maids were my sources of information. They were ever-flowing fountains of trivial gossip. They could come and go freely in the palace. They could study the men from all angles. They could listen in on their conversations. They could laugh and joke with them as much as they pleased. No one cared who might worm his way in between their legs. "Who's the barrel-chested one?" I asked. Page 31. "Oh, that's only Odysseus," said one of the maids. He was not considered, by the maids at least, to be a serious candidate for my hand. His father's palace was on Ithaca, a goat-strewn rock. His clothes were rustic. He had the manners of a small-town bigshot and had already expressed several complicated ideas the others considered peculiar. He was clever, though, they said. In fact, he was too clever for his own good. The other young men made jokes about him. "Don't gamble with Odysseus, the friend of Hermes," they said. "You'll never win." This was like saying he was a cheat and a thief. His grandfather, Autolycus, was well known for these very qualities and was reputed never to have won anything fairly in his life. "I wonder how fast he can run," I said. In some kingdoms, the contest for brides was a wrestling match, in others a chariot race, but with us it was just running. "Not very fast on those short legs of his," said one maid unkindly. And indeed, the legs of Odysseus were quite short in relation to his body. It was all right when he was sitting down, you didn't notice, but standing up, he looked top-heavy. Page 32. "Not fast enough to catch you," said another of the maids. "You wouldn't want to wake up in the morning and find yourself in bed with your husband and a herd of Apollo's cows." This was a joke about Hermes, whose first act of thievery on the day he was born involved an audacious cattle raid. "Not unless one of them was a bull," said another. "Or else a goat," said a third. "A big, strong ram. I bet our young duck would like that. She'd be bleeding soon enough." "I wouldn't mind one of that kind myself," said a fourth. "Better a ram than the baby fingers you get around here." They all began laughing, holding their hands over their mouths and snorting with mirth. I was mortified. I didn't understand the coarser kinds of jokes, not yet, so I didn't know exactly why they were laughing, though I understood that their laughter was at my expense. But I had no way of making them stop. Page 33. At this moment, my cousin Helen came sailing up like the long-necked swan she fancied herself to be. She had a distinctive swaying walk, and she was exaggerating it. Although mine was the marriage in question, she wanted all the attention for herself. She was as beautiful as usual, indeed more so. She was intolerably beautiful. She was dressed to perfection. Menelaus, her husband, always made sure of that, and he was rich as stink, so he could afford it. She tilted her face towards me, looking at me whimsically as if she were flirting. I suspect she used to flirt with her dog, with her mirror, with her comb, with her bedpost. She needed to keep in practice. "I think Odysseus would make a very suitable husband for our little ducky," she said. "She likes the quiet life, and she'll certainly have that if he takes her to Ithaca, as he's boasting of doing. She can help him look after his goats. She and Odysseus are two of a kind. They both have such short legs." She said this lightly, but her lightest sayings were often her cruelest. Why is it that really beautiful pink people think everyone else in the world exists merely for their amusement? Page 34. The maids sniggered. I was crushed. I had not thought my legs were quite that short, and I certainly hadn't thought Helen would notice them. But not much escaped her when it came to assessing the physical graces and defects of others. That was what got her into trouble with Paris later. He was so much better looking than Menelaus, who was lumpish and red-haired. The best that was claimed of Menelaus, once they started putting him into the poems, was that he had a very loud voice. The maids all looked at me to see what I would say, but Helen had a way of leaving people speechless, and I was no exception. "Never mind, little cousin," she said to me, patting me on the arm. "They say he's very clever, and you're very clever too, they tell me, so you'll be able to understand what he says. I certainly never could. It was lucky for both of us that he didn't win me."